all the way to Putin today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The Washington Post says Russian efforts to interfere in the U.S. election were directed by Vladimir Putin himself.
The fact that this went all the way to Putin does make it somewhat extraordinary.
But when it comes to cyber warfare, we're not the only target. We'll hear how Russia used Ukraine to test its cyber attacks.
It was a sign that a reusable tool has been built and it could just as easily be used in Western Europe or in the United States.
Plus, as the holy month of Ramadan ends, a personal reflection on what it means for many Muslims.
They say Ramadan Kareem, which means Ramadan is generous. This is part of the tradition, like during the month of Ramadan, people give and give abundance.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Happy Friday. Russia, the story that just won't go away. President Donald Trump was on Fox News, Fox and Friends program this morning, and once again, he denied evidence of any wrongdoing when it comes to Russian meddling in the election he won.
Look, there has been no obstruction. There has been no collusion. There has been leaking by Comey, but there's been no collusion, no obstruction, and virtually everybody agrees to that.
And yet more details continue to emerge. The latest story, published today by The Washington Post, reveals new information about Russia's hacking efforts. The Post reports that not only did the Russians attempt to interfere with the election, but that the interference was directed by Vladimir Putin himself. According to the story, Putin's goal was to defeat or at least damage Hillary Clinton and help elect Trump. The CIA reportedly presented President Obama with this information in early August. The Post also describes in detail how the Obama administration responded or failed to respond. Daniel Dresner is professor of international politics at the Fletcher School at Tufts. He says he finds several things surprising about the story.
One of the things that stands out is the degree to which Republicans were somewhat intransigent with the idea of there being a foreign attack. So the story quotes by name the Georgia Secretary of State not believing that there was any kind of Russian interference. And of course, the Obama administration wanted to issue a sort of joint bipartisan statement warning about the Russian attacks, but Mitch McConnell in the Senate scotched that idea, proclaiming skepticism that Russia was actually behind this.
You know, I know it's 2020 hindsight, but you read this report and then you think about how the Obama administration responded, and it was really muted. Isn't it fair to sort of think that there should have been a stronger response just by virtue of the facts of this case, that a Russian leader had personally orchestrated this?
The fact that Putin, this went all the way to Putin does make it somewhat extraordinary. I mean, other countries have tried to hack into party headquarters in the past. This is not unique to this round, but the depth and scope of what Russia did this time does seem to be unusual. And in some ways, you can argue that what happened was this played to Barack Obama's greatest weakness as a foreign policy president, which is his tendency to deliberate and move very slowly in response to sudden shifts elsewhere. And it seems clear Obama agonized over what was the right thing to do, recognizing fairly that if he took a very strong stance, he might be accused by Republicans of acting in a partisan manner to defend Hillary Clinton rather than acting in terms of the national interest. So you can see why he was potentially conflicted on this.
What do you recommend be done now?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that could be done. The most obvious is that you very much want, and this was clearly the top priority of the administration, was you don't want Russia to actually be able to hack the state-level election infrastructure. Step two, and this is a much deeper problem, is the degree to which Russian disinformation, much more so than hacking or anything like that, really did seem to have at least some degree of impact on the way people thought about the election. So you can argue that in politics, controlling the narrative is pretty powerful. And Russia, to some extent, was able to at least at times shift the narrative. That's not a minor thing.
Daniel Dresner is professor of international politics at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. There's one country that definitely knows Russia's hacking abilities, Ukraine. It's been locked in conflict with Russia since 2014, including in cyberspace. Groups of Russian hackers have systematically targeted nearly every industry in Ukraine. And some analysts think Ukraine is just the testing ground for Russia's cyber warfare. Andy Greenberg is a reporter at Wired. I asked him to describe the digital attacks Ukraine has been facing.
All of this actually started in a way that feels very parallel to the United States with an attack on the Ukrainian election in 2014. hackers broke into the network of the Central Election Committee and tried to spoof the results of the election on the committee's website and declare the results for this ultra far right candidate who had only gotten a tiny percentage of votes. And the Russian media simultaneously was ready to go out with the story that that candidate had won. They seemed to be collaborating. So that was just the beginning. Over the next 3 years, literally every strata of Ukrainian society has been hit by cyber attacks. The railway ticketing system has been shut down. The finance ministry has had terabytes of data deleted while it was trying to prepare its budget for the next year. And all of this culminated in two separate attacks on the Ukrainian power grid that caused actual blackouts for hundreds of thousands of people.
I think a lot of people think hackers can only cause chaos on the web, but this is direct physical damage. Were those blackouts one of the first times we saw something like this?
I think the only other time we've seen something like this was with this notorious piece of malware called Stuxnet, launched by the NSA and Israeli intelligence in 2009 to destroy nuclear enrichment centrifuges in an Iranian facility.
And that worked.
And that did work. And ever since then, the cybersecurity community has been warning that the next shoe would drop, that hackers would again cross this barrier from using digital attacks to attack digital targets to using digital attacks to attack physical targets. And that's what's happened here for the first time ever.
You talk to people like Robert Lee. He's a former U.S. intelligence analyst who now leads a cybersecurity startup. How did Lee and the others you spoke to manage to piece together what was happening in Ukraine and realize the potential threat to the U.S.?
Well, the American cybersecurity community jumped on this very quickly. After Ukraine declared that this was the work of hackers, well, initially everyone was very skeptical because squirrels tend to cause blackouts more often than hackers. But eventually, a whole delegation of Americans were invited by the Ukrainian government to visit and actually talked with all three of these regional electric companies that were hit by the hackers. So they were able to assemble a very detailed forensic portrait of how these attacks occurred.
Now, what makes cybersecurity analysts think that Ukraine is just a testing ground for Russia's hacking abilities?
There were actually two blackout attacks. There was one in 2015 that was done very manually, a very sophisticated attack that used probably dozens of hackers working at once with lots of resources. But then a year later, there was another blackout attack, and this one only lasted for 1 hour. It took out about a fifth of the energy capacity of Kiev, the capital. And in this case, it was pulled off by a really unprecedented automated piece of malware. And it basically automated everything that had been done in 2015. It was a sign that it was a test of something to come, that a kind of reusable tool has been built and it could just as easily be used in Western Europe or in the United States.
How susceptible is the U.S. to cyber attacks on its infrastructure?
Well, the good news is that our actual IT security is much, much better. But on the other hand, our grid is also much more automated, which means that there are many more targets that you could take over and use to cause a blackout. And we're not as accustomed in the U.S. to dealing with blackouts. Ukraine has frequent blackouts just from their kind of antiquated infrastructure. So they're very good at turning the power back on. So if there were to be a catastrophic blackout, it might be more serious and it might take us longer to turn it back on.
So we now have some clues as to how Russia is doing this, but why is Russia doing it?
Well, Russia is at war with Ukraine, and Russia seems determined to destabilize Ukraine in lots of ways. But it also seems that Russia is testing things in Ukraine and possibly signaling to the international community that it has these capabilities. We know that the U.S. has the ability to do these things as well. The U.S. built the first piece of malware that could cause physical disruption. So maybe Russia is sending a message to the United States or to any other country that would dare to attack its infrastructure or even use those kinds of attacks in parts of the world where it has interests, like in Syria. It's a form of deterrence that Russia can wield to maintain its ability to do what it wants in the world.
That's reporter Andy Greenberg, whose article lights out how an entire nation became Russia's test lab for cyber war. It's Wired Magazine's cover story this month. Thanks, Andy.
Thank you.
A mystery. That's how a spokesman for the North Korean government describes the death of 22-year-old American student Otto Warmbier. Warmbier was on a tour of North Korea when he was arrested for allegedly stealing an item of propaganda. That was in January of 2016. Last week, North Korea released him, but he arrived home in a coma, and on Monday, Warmbier died. Many suspect Warmbier was mistreated during his captivity, but today North Korean authorities denied that. Isaac Stonefish has been writing about this for Politico, and he's learned new details on the tour group that Warmbier was a part of.
Young Pioneer Tours, which took Otto to North Korea, promises fun, thrill-seeking, and adventure at great price. But unfortunately, according to several of the people I spoke with who were on the tour with Otto, there was not the right culture of responsibility that you really need when you take people into North Korea. Two people described a culture of recklessness and intoxication that one of them even alleged might have paved the groundwork for what happened to Otto.
So you mentioned there seemed to be a certain recklessness. What are the examples in terms of how this tour where the Otto was on was run?
So people described just an absurd amount of drinking. Drinking is very socially acceptable in North Korea, but a couple of people expressed concern that their guides seemed too drunk to really make good decisions, to have good judgment. One example that someone told me, and which the person wrote a TripAdvisor review of, concerns taking the train back from Pyongyang to Beijing at the end of the trip. What happened on this train ride was that the Canadian friend of one of the tour guides hid the passport of one tourist who was from Hong Kong. And the wife of this tourist was understandably very upset by this because the North Korean guards were interrogating her husband because he didn't seem to have a passport. And she was crying, and the guide was mocking her, and eventually they gave her husband back the passport. But as you can understand, this was a very upsetting experience for her.
So what else happened that made this kind of an uncharacteristic Young Pioneers tour?
The other thing that happened was a British member of the tour on New Year's disappeared for roughly several hours.
So they're in Pyongyang, it's New Year's Eve, and this guy disappears.
They were carousing in Kim Il-sung Square, which is a major public square in the center of the city, and he wanders off with another American, and the American joins him. It's a really festive occasion. A lot of North Koreans are following them. He described it as he was like the Pied Piper. And then the American turns back, and the British guy keeps going into the darkness. Now, this may seem like a very insignificant anecdote. Someone gets separated from a tour group. Big deal. Things are very different in North Korea. That is not allowed to happen in Pyongyang. And the guides, the North Korean guides, were very upset by this. He wandered off for, you know, again, it seemed like a couple of hours. I'm not sure the exact amount of time. And then made his way back to the hotel.
Has the tour company, the Young Pioneers Tour Company, responded to these criticisms?
They haven't. I emailed them several times and offered them the chance to do so. And they said they were going to respond and didn't. I did speak to one person who went on the tour with Otto and then later became a guide at Young Pioneers. And he spoke of having a very positive experience.
Have you ever visited North Korea?
I have. I visited twice. And they were sort of a different era in North Korea because it was before Kim Jong-un, the current leader, took power in December 2011 following the death of his father, Kim Jong-il.
Was it on a Young Pioneers tour?
It was not, no.
Would you go back to North Korea?
If I had not taken this career path and was a average, cautious, adventurous American, then I would say it is a very good idea to go to North Korea. You have to keep your wits about you. You have to follow North Korean rules. But I don't believe traveling to North Korea is more dangerous than traveling to a lot of other places around the world that Americans go to.
Isaac Stonefish is a journalist. He's also a senior fellow at the Asia Society. He's written about the North Korean Young Pioneers Tour for Politico. Thanks, Isaac.
Thank you.
Coming up in a bit, being undocumented and Irish in the U.S. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. After the 9/11 attacks, the U.S. government developed harsh interrogation techniques to use on terror suspects, techniques that are now widely regarded as torture. The American Civil Liberties Union has brought a lawsuit in federal court on behalf of some ex-detainees, but the lawsuit doesn't target the CIA. Instead, it's aimed at two government contractors, psychologists who CIA officials claim are the architects of the interrogation program. Sherry Fink is covering the case for The New York Times. Sherry, tell us about these psychologists. Who are James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen?
James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen were former military psychologists, and they became CIA contractors in the months after 9/11. Both of them had experience at so-called SEER schools, which is survival schools for our military personnel, and they undergo some training to try to help them resist what could possibly be the type of questioning that they might have if they were captured by an enemy that didn't follow the laws of war, that actually tortured. And so they undergo mock waterboarding, this sort of simulated drowning in some of these schools, and then all these other really, really harsh techniques.
And so they effectively turned that around and made recommendations to use these techniques on terrorism suspects.
So when the CIA set up secret prisons around the world, they were looking for a way to get information from terrorism suspects. And some of the leadership wanted to try something different. And James Mitchell had this idea, or maybe a few people did, but he was the one who was sort of brought in. And he and his colleague, Dr. Jessen, decided to propose using versions of some of these survival school techniques to question actual terrorism suspects. So there are so many ways in which that's different. I mean, somebody who goes through survival school knows that this is a training program. Also, there are very careful ways in which those techniques are used on our service members who are training. Of course, the context is totally different when you take them, you re-engineer them, and you apply them in a secret CIA prison on actual terrorism suspects. But that's what these two psychologists proposed. They describe sitting down, typing up a list based on some of those SEER training techniques.
And what was on the list? What are some of those techniques they recommended?
There were about a dozen, and they included everything from a so-called insult slap, where you like a very carefully prescribed slap to somebody's face, to harsher things such as confining men in cramped spaces, almost like coffins, but even smaller, to the most notorious of the proposed techniques, which was waterboarding. So a cloth is placed over the detainee's mouth and nose, and water is poured over that cloth, and it is a very convincing form of simulated drowning.
Now, I know for this story you did for The Times, you watched hours of deposition tapes, and these psychologists answer a lot of questions about how they came up with what they did. And excerpts from those tapes are on The Times website. And a couple of things struck me as I watched them. First, in the depositions, the psychologists kept downplaying the severity of the techniques. Here's Dr. Mitchell describing the effect of being walled. And before we play the clip, what is being walled?
Being walled is where you could kind of like put some sort of a cloth around the detainee's neck and use that to swing them into a wall. And I think, according to CIA documents, the first time they did it was like a concrete wall, and then they used a flexible wall, like a plywood wall, to create less damage to the actual detainee.
Okay, here's Dr. Mitchell, and this is how he describes it.
Oh, it's discombobulating. It's not painful. It stirs up your inner ears, and it's like being on one of those whirly gigs or something.
Now, Dr. Mitchell also had a pretty cavalier attitude when it came to waterboarding. In this tape, first you're going to hear the lawyer asking a question.
I mean, you thought waterboarding was a bad thing, was a painful thing, right?
No, I thought it could be done safely. I thought he would be uncomfortable. It sucks, mm-hmm. You know. I don't know that it's painful.
I saw an interview.
But it's distressing.
Mm-hmm. I saw an interview with you where you said it was as between somebody breaking their leg and somebody being waterboarded, most people would choose to have their leg broken. Do you remember saying that in an interview?
No.
And then the lawyer plays back a tape of that interview.
Okay. Now, you're using the word painful. I'm using the word distressing.
Okay.
Two things are not synonymous in my mind.
So, Sherry, do you think Mitchell is kind of trying to cover up what he did by minimizing it?
Well, what we have to remember when we view these tapes is that they're depositions for a trial. There are men suing them, accusing them of torture, of human experimentation. And so torture has certain definitions. So certainly we need to keep the context in mind. But certainly what you hear in that bit of tape that you played is a man who is really parsing words very carefully. And that was very characteristic throughout those hours of tapes, is that so much seemed to ride for him on individual words like pain versus distress. You know, one thing that we hear with Dr. Jessen, who notably, what was so notable about these depositions is that Dr. Jessen, by contrast, is very much defending, you know, if these techniques were done in exactly the way that we propose, then they're, you know, I'm confident that they didn't cause any sort of like particular lasting type of harm. On the other side, he is also expressing some ambivalence. He talks about having wanted to stop, having never wanted to get kind of so harsh with these techniques. And I want to just say, in terms of terminology, we're using words like harsh and whatnot. There are, of course, many people who feel that this was torture. In fact, at the New York Times, we have a editorial policy of calling these set of techniques that were imposed in these CIA secret prisons torture. But in this case, I think we're being careful here in this interview, just because it is a judge who is going to have to make this decision about some of these terms, the legal definitions of torture.
Another aspect of this story is the theme of personal responsibility within a larger system. Can you tell us a little bit more about this and what you sensed about that with Jessen and Mitchell?
Sure. This case really is about personal responsibility within a system that's doing questionable things, and things that I should hasten to say that our government banned these techniques after they came to public notice, after there were multiple investigations. So let's say that first. So if you're within a system like that, that's getting, you know, telling you to do something, what is the individual's responsibility if the government says it's legal at that moment? So this case really rests on two individual contractors who had a large part, allegedly and according to the evidence, in implementing these techniques, in proposing them. Ultimately, they formed a contracting company. They kept going for years, got $81 million for this company to implement this program. So, you know, is it enough to say, well, I was following orders, I was serving my country said it was legal? This case is a test of that argument.
The New York Times' Sherry Fink on the psychologists who devised the harsh interrogation techniques used on detainees after 9/11. Sherry, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Carol Hills. Virtual reality can reconnect families separated by borders and immigration status, and it can be a joyful experience.
But then turn sour because maybe a grandma in Mexico can only see their relatives through these kind of silly goggles on their face.
A virtual reunion that brings real tears ahead on the world. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Last week, a prominent leader of Boston's Irish immigrant community was arrested. Many were shocked. The World's Kenya Downs has been following the story. Kenya, the Irish immigrant who was arrested, his name is John Cunningham. Who is he and what's his story?
John is a local immigrant activist who has been in the U.S. for more than 15 years, and he's been living here undocumented. And recently he began speaking out to the media about his experiences. In fact, last week, ICE agents showed up to his home in Boston's Brighton neighborhood to take him into custody. And now he's in detention awaiting deportation back to Ireland.
And so what strikes you about how Boston's Irish immigrant community has responded to this arrest?
Well, one thing that's unique about Boston is that it has a long history of Irish immigration, both legally and otherwise. So it's a badge of pride and honor for folks to tout their Irish ancestry or first generation status. And it was unexpected for a lot of folks. In fact, I had a chance to talk with Ronnie Miller, who he's the executive director of the Irish International Immigrant Center here in Boston. And he says this essentially blindsided Boston's Irish community.
It's outrageous that somebody who has been here for 18 years, who's been paying taxes, who's contributing to the community, who's making this a healthier, better place, would be snatched from his home and deported. It's really, really outrageous.
Why are people so surprised? I mean, if he was undocumented and more undocumented are being arrested, why is Boston's Irish community so surprised by it?
Well, the fact that ICE agents showed up to his home is what makes this particularly unique for Irish immigrants here in Boston. And the fact that he had for a very long time been an advocate and an outspoken about immigration issues here in the community. But it wasn't until he began making media appearances that people began to feel like he might have been targeted. But many do acknowledge that, you know, it's pretty surprising because the community has acknowledged essentially a privilege they've shared or had in not being as aggressively pursued as perhaps Boston's Haitian or Guatemalan community, and that speaks to the importance of Irish culture and heritage and immigration to Boston that they've flown under the radar for such a long time. Still, Miller told me that it never meant that undocumented immigrants here ever really felt invincible.
So I'm not sure that I would fully agree that people sort of were complacent, but in one sense, statistically, the Irish are not being targeted.
How do Irish immigrants typically end up undocumented?
Well, the U.S. doesn't require many European nations to obtain visas to travel to the U.S., and so that allows for particularly Irish and other European immigrants to come to the U.S. on these visa waiver programs. They allow for temporary work or pursuing other educational or work opportunities for up to 3 months. And because of that combination of factors, including better job opportunities here in the U.S. and also an economic downturn in Ireland, many people choose to stay. Miller told me also that many of these are young, undocumented Irish immigrants, and often they're not aware of the consequences of doing that.
What is U.S. immigration and enforcement saying about this arrest?
Well, in a statement, ICE acknowledged that Cunningham's arrest was for overstaying a 90-day visa. And they also point out that because he came under this visa waiver program, like we mentioned, he essentially waived his rights to a hearing before an immigration judge and is subject to mandatory detention.
Now, I know there's been some criticism within immigration circles about Cunningham's arrest and that it's getting so much attention. Why is that?
Well, many people I talked with say that if Cunningham weren't a white Irish immigrant, then perhaps his arrest wouldn't have generated this amount of news coverage. The Boston community also has a very vibrant Haitian, Guatemalan, Cape Verdean, and other communities, and there are black and brown people who are taken into custody or arrested every day. And so people are pointing out some of the racial connotations that may be there in terms of why Mr. Cunningham's story is getting more attention at the moment than perhaps many other black and brown immigrants. And we'll explore more on the racial connotations of immigration enforcement more as it relates to Mr. Cunningham's story and other immigrants in the community next week.
Look forward to hearing it. The world's Kenya Downs. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So let's say you live in the U.S., but for whatever reason, you can't go back to your home country. What might be the next best thing? Well, two young immigrants here in the U.S. are using virtual reality to reunite friends and loved ones. But it can be a bittersweet reunion. Here's reporter Zadie Stavely.
We're at a wedding in Mexico. It's a video of a wedding, actually. The bride and groom exchange vows, and the party starts. It's not just any video, though. It's virtual reality. You put on special goggles, and it feels like you're there. You can look up or down and see and hear everything around you. It's a virtual reality experiment called the Family Reunions Project. I met the project's creators in San Francisco at a conference for immigrant entrepreneurs. One of them, Alvaro Morales, told me how this wedding video is a part of the project. See, last year, Morales met the bride's brother in Virginia. He told Morales he couldn't go to his little sister's wedding because he's undocumented. If he went to Mexico, he wouldn't be able to return to the U.S. Morales says this is why he's working with virtual reality, to take people back home in a way, to places that feel cut off, or maybe just too expensive to visit.
Places that they're effectively barred from returning to, like your home countries, your neighborhood, the home that you grew up in, and get messages from the people that you may be kind of disconnected from, at least in the physical world.
Morales was so excited about the idea, he quit his job as an analyst to work on it with Frizzly Soberanis, a video producer. They're both immigrants, too. Came to the U.S. as kids. Morales is from Peru. Soberanis is from Guatemala.
Our community is like a perfect example of how we can use this medium to, you know, bridge gaps and cross borders, essentially.
The first videos they produced were for Soberanis' own parents. His mom, Marlene, lives in New York City, and Soberanis created videos to take her back to Guatemala, to her hometown, the streets there, to her grandfather's home. Here's Soberanis' mom watching one of the videos, wearing the virtual reality goggles. She's back home, and it hits her hard to see the palm trees from her childhood, her relatives. She suddenly takes the goggles off.
Ay, no. Eso sí me hizo llorar.
She's sobbing. She hasn't been back home for 15 years, since she was 25 years old.
¿Sabías que no conocía la casa de mi abuelito?
You know I've never been to my grandfather's house, she says, and now they showed it to me. I wish I could be there. Then it's time for Soberanis' dad to put on the goggles and watch a video of his old friends in Guatemala catching up. They knew he'd watch the video, so one by one, they reach out to him to shake his hand, as if he were there too. What's up, Chaparrito, Chiquilín? His friends use nicknames in Spanish that mean shorty or little guy. Standing in his living room in New York, Soberanis' dad reaches out his hand to them, as if he were there, with friends he hasn't seen for years. When it's over, he takes off the goggles. He's smiling.
Bien bonito.
Really nice, he says. Lovely. His smile fades, though. He looks down at the floor. He's quiet for a while. Soberanis is a bit surprised by the reaction. He didn't realize how hard these videos would hit his parents.
I didn't realize how much he was missing. I didn't realize like how much pain migration was, obviously, because I grew up here and I like my friends are here. Half of his life was in Guatemala. And so for me to be able to see that he missed it a lot was a very intense experience for me and also for him.
Last winter, Morales, the other creator of the videos, traveled to Peru and Mexico to record more 360-degree videos. He went to family dinners, toured different neighborhoods, elementary schools, all places that immigrants in the U.S. had asked him to record.
To bring them back to places that you have this deep connection to, but you almost forgot what it looked like, and really be able to see like which walls were painted, like how you think things may look like much smaller, or how people have grown or aged.
Morales knew the project would be emotional. It's beyond seeing photos on Facebook or calling relatives over Skype. He says he wasn't prepared for what people did when they put on the goggles and stepped into a virtual reality postcard.
So a lot of people would talk back to virtual characters. They would go for the hugs, even though they understood that it was not a live stream, that it had been pre-recorded. That completely took me aback.
Morales says it can be hard seeing they're bringing pain to people.
It can be a really joyful experience, but then it turns sour because virtual reality has a good way of highlighting the distance and the cruelty. The fact that his parents or maybe grandma in Mexico can only see their relatives through these kind of silly goggles on their face.
Morales and Soberanis are working on a documentary about their experience. They say one thing they're very clear about is that virtual reality doesn't take away the pain of family separation. It just brings that pain to light. For The World, Zadie Stavely, San Francisco.
Want to know what one of those virtual reunion videos looks like? We've collected some for you at PRI.org. Stop by and check them out. Yesterday, the Associated Press broke a story that sounded straight out of the U.S. war in Afghanistan. It was about secret prisons, torture, detentions, and moving detainees from prison to prison. It has to do with the war on terror, but it's not in Afghanistan. It's in Yemen. The prisons are maintained by a U.S. ally, the United Arab Emirates, and the reports of torture have been well documented. Joining me via Skype is a researcher who went to Yemen to investigate this for Human Rights Watch. Christine Beckerle, give us the headline and why should people in the United States care?
People in the United States should care because at this point you now have two separate investigations, one by the AP, one by Human Rights Watch, about rampant abuse in prisons run by UAE-backed Yemeni forces or the UAE itself in Yemen. And now you have the AP saying the U.S. not only is working very closely with the UAE in counterterror campaigns in Yemen, but also has sent in interrogators to interrogate people in some of these places.
Christine, in terms of the kinds of things that are being alleged, the AP is reporting that there's a certain thing that's being used in these interrogations called the grill. What is that?
So what the AP was reporting was that they heard reports from former detainees that someone was basically put on a pole and spun over hot flames. We at Human Rights Watch have documented a variety of different forms of what appear to be abuse and torture, including electric shocks, beating with metal objects, forced nudity, sexual harassment, threats, sleep deprivation, sensory deprivation. And this is coming from not one person or not two people, but from a variety of different people who are saying that the treatment in these detention facilities is horrible, to put it bluntly.
Christine, did you talk to any detainees who'd been tortured? And what was that like?
Yeah, so we interviewed people who had been detained, and to be frank, it was hard. Actually, in the one that I'm remembering most clearly, he was more focused on friends and family members who were still disappeared because he was worried about what would happen to them. But then as the interview went on, he sort of quietly mentioned that, you know, most people had it worse than him, but some things had also happened to him. And then he sort of started opening up about the things that had happened to him in terms of beatings, shocks, and all of these things. And I remember sort of sitting there and just looking at him, because you have this person telling you about horrible conditions, horrible treatment, and yet his focus is on all the other people that were detained with him who he felt had it worse, and for his friends and family who were still disappeared, who he had no idea what had happened to them.
And what is the evidence that American forces were involved?
So basically what the AP reported is that the U.S. said that it was in fact cooperating with the UAE. So you have that on the admission of the U.S. that they saw transcripts of some of these interrogations. They shared questions that they themselves sent in U.S. officials to take part in interrogations. They denied taking part in any of the abuse that we documented. But the problem is, it's very hard to claim clean hands when, again, you've now got two separate investigations, multiple reports by Yemeni actors of abuse, torture in the same facilities and by the same forces that the U.S. is cooperating closely with in counterterror campaigns in Yemen.
I should mention here that we asked the U.S. State Department to comment, and they told us they knew about the report, but to ask the Department of Defense, and the Department of Defense wrote to us, as a matter of policy, we do not discuss the details of bilateral intelligence arrangements with partner nations. Christine, did any of the Yemenis you spoke to say that they were interrogated by an American?
None of the Yemenis that we interviewed said that they were interrogated by Americans. But what Yemenis we interviewed said was that in terms of following up on family members who had been disappeared, that they had been told by various people that the case was, quote unquote, with the Americans. And I think that's very, very scary for a Yemeni person whose family member has been missing for months to hear that not only are they not going to get answers to how their family member is doing, if they're still alive, where they are, but that it's now with the Americans. Again, when you're talking about a country, Yemen, that's had to deal with a lot of violations in the, quote unquote, war on terror over the last 15 years.
What does Human Rights Watch want the United States to do?
Human Rights Watch wants the United States, and in particular the United Arab Emirates, to first of all deal with these claims in a serious way, because the UAE told the Associated Press that there were no secret prisons, but that claim beggars belief, because again, you've got two separate investigations, tons of Yemenis documenting and reporting on these issues. And the U.S. is saying it itself has not been involved in these abuses. But the problem that you've got is, even if the U.S. is not itself torturing people, even if the U.S. is not itself abusing people, if the U.S. is benefiting from torture or abuse, that raises serious international law concerns. And that's sort of the question on the table, is what was the U.S. aware of? Now that the U.S. has to be aware, given this public reporting, what steps is it going to take to pressure its partner, the UAE, one of its main partners in the counterterror campaigns in Yemen, to cease these abuses and redress them?
Christine Beckerle is a researcher for Human Rights Watch. Thanks, Christine.
Thanks very much.
Some updates now on stories we've been following. Yesterday, we mentioned the Carrier manufacturing plant in Indiana. Donald Trump had made a deal to save hundreds of jobs at the plant from being moved to Mexico. He touted it as a great victory, but cuts were always part of the deal. Carrier's just announced the first round of layoffs to begin next month. And the millions in promised investment in the plant? That will go toward increasing automation. Now to another story we reported last week from Detroit. It was about Iraqis living in the U.S. being sent back to Iraq. Our reporter spoke with families in Michigan who feared their loved ones could be deported at any moment as a result of an agreement between the Trump administration and the Iraqi government. Here's the update. A federal judge has halted these deportations for 2 weeks. The judge argued that the potential harm for these deportees far outweighs any interest the government might have in sending them back to Iraq. And one last story we want to update. It concerns 17-year-old Nabra Hassanan. She was killed early Sunday morning near her mosque in Northern Virginia. Initially, many called the killing a hate crime and said that Hassanan had been targeted for being Muslim. But Virginia authorities said her murder was an act of road rage. And now a new wrinkle in the story. It turns out that the girl's alleged killer is an undocumented immigrant from El Salvador who authorities say entered the U.S. illegally. The World's Maria Muriel joins us to discuss the case. Maria, what are people saying about the suspect in Nabra's murder?
Unfortunately, since the news came out earlier this week, people have been applying their own political narrative to it. And now that everyone found out the suspect is an undocumented immigrant from El Salvador, I've seen a lot of conservative blogs say things like it's kind of a told you so moment for them against liberals who purportedly were saying it was a hate crime.
But police investigating the case have not declared it a hate crime, have they?
Right. They said that it was an incident of road rage that Darwin Martinez Torres, who's a 22-year-old Salvadoran immigrant, kidnapped and beat Nabra to death because there was an altercation between him and some teenagers that she was with outside of her mosque. So police believe that he had a different motive than Islamophobia. But this doesn't mean and it doesn't discount that there is Islamophobia in the Latino community. And in fact, since Nabra's death, there's been a lot more conversations about Islamophobia in the Latin community online. Like, there's been a couple of different blogs and hashtags started about Latinx communities and Islamophobia.
Has Martinez Torres's undocumented status caused any backlash?
Absolutely. Some people are saying that this is the kind of crime that President Trump's immigration crackdown is designed to prevent. And actually, just yesterday, Alex Noraste from the Libertarian Cato Institute was speaking at Georgetown University about immigrant crime rate. And he compared incarceration rates between native-born Americans and immigrants. And immigrant crime rates are always lower. Then he subtracted incarcerations for immigration-related violations for undocumented immigrants specifically. And this is what he had to say about the crime rate of undocumented immigrants.
Their incarceration rate is about exactly the same as it is for lawful immigrants in the United States. So when people tell me that lawful immigrants or illegal immigrants and lawful ones are crime-prone and we can't measure it, I like to show them this type of evidence.
Despite those statistics, the Trump administration has a hotline set up for people to report immigrant crimes.
Right. It's called the Victims of Immigration Crime Engagement Office, or VOICE, and it was meant for people exactly like Nabra Hassanan's family to report this kind of crime. And Noraste from the Cato Institute says, actually, that this kind of government initiative is not new to the U.S.
And by the way, if you go all the way back to the early 1900s, you take a look at every government commission, usually started to make immigrants look bad, studying this issue, couldn't mess with the numbers enough to make it look like immigrants are more crime prone.
So the data seems to consistently say that immigrants are not more dangerous.
Right. That's all. That's what the data usually shows. And this crime in Virginia was a horrific killing of a young girl, a young Muslim girl. But independent of the demographics involved, since it happened, since the news came out, people on all sides of the political spectrum have been trying to use it to defend their narrative.
The World's Maria Muriel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Carol.
Finally, if you get a look at the night sky tonight, you'll see the moon is down to a slim crescent. That means the holy month of Ramadan is coming to a close. For Muslims around the world, Ramadan is about fasting, praying, and for some, singing. Abu Bakr Fakhri is director of youth programming at the Islamic Society of Boston Cultural Center. He shared some of his favorite Ramadan songs with us.
So I'll sing something. It's called Qamarun. قمرون قمرون قمر سيدنا النبي قمرون.
قمر in Arabic means moon, and in the Arabic tradition, if you want to describe something very, like something super beautiful, you would say it looks like the moon.
قمرون قمرون.
And they use the same term to describe the face of the Prophet, peace be upon him. It says, وَكُلُّ الْكَوْنِ أَنَا رَبِّ نُورِ طَهَا. And like, his light has filled the whole earth. And light, again, it's metaphoric, used in the Arabic language. When you want to say that someone has brought a lot of good, people would say, his light just filled the whole earth. وجميل سيدنا النبي وجميل. You know how people greet each other during the month of Ramadan? They say Ramadan Kareem, which means Ramadan is generous. And I was once volunteering when I used to live in Egypt to distribute meals. This is part of the tradition, like during the month of Ramadan, people give and give abundance. And then when you go to the poor areas, you expect people to be only receiving the food. However, it's actually the opposite. So on that day, I was driving in my car, basically attempting to deliver the meals, and everyone else is basically showering me with whether it's dates or juice or snack that I can eat on my way home in case like sunset comes before I reach the house. And I was putting the radio on, and it was towards the end of the month. And the guy on the radio said, "The generous month is about to end." And I immediately started crying. I don't know why, but I had never felt generosity in such a profound way like that night. You could see how generous people become, whether they have or they don't. Everyone gives. Ramadan hu hal ihlal ya halawat an-nur ya jamal. Ramadan hu hal ihlal ya halawat an-nur ya jamal. والسعد هلاح أهلا أهلا رمضان والقلب ارتاح أهلا أهلا رمضان والسعد هلاح أهلا أهلا رمضان والقلب ارتاح أهلا أهلا رمضان والقلب كمن غناله.
أبو بكر فاكري spoke with producer Ian Koss. Thousands of people joined Fakhri to break the fast this week here in Boston. You can see what that was like. We've posted a video on our Facebook page. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We'll see you next week.
PRI, Public Radio International.